Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, welcome to the 193rd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Pamela Almeida, Curtis Ratliff, and Ryan C. Henderson. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Unlow. Today we've got Micah Fitzerman Blue on. Most notably, he's got a hit movie out called A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. It's the story of Mr. Rogers and a curmudgeonly and maybe a little depressed reporter coming to terms with his own empathy, thanks to the help of Mr. Rogers. And it's really great. We dig in on the process of, while also navigating a career writing television, how you kind of balance those passion projects with the upfront work that you have to do, the role of being a writer-producer, how that sort of works, and also, like always, the nitty-gritty of specifically the steps that he took to find that success.
Yeah, what I love about Micah and kind of digging into his career is that he's done so many different things. He was like one of the head writers on Transparent from season one, kind of side by side with Jill Soloway. He wrote Maleficent 2, this like giant Disney film. He is doing a new show for Netflix. He has this movie right now that is based off a script that he had written like almost 10 years ago that was on the blacklist. He is just really amazing at finding really interesting stories and figuring out like what is like honest and heartful and emotional. And I really love what he said about what he looks for in directors when he's thinking about TV and movies. So super excited to have him on the podcast. And before we get into the show, we're going to talk to one of our sponsors, Daniel from MusicBed. Daniel, you were a filmmaker. Can you give us advice on how to determine whether a video, a short, an ad needs music with the lyrics versus music without an instrumental or more of a score piece?
That's a great question. I mean, I think some of it's practical. Like, is there a bunch of talking? Is there a voiceover? I think it's always a bad idea to put any sort of melody line over a voiceover. But I think when you're coming in and out of things, it's good specifically for ads. You know, people don't leave watching something like whistling the electric guitar part, right? So the thing that gets stuck in their head is ultimately always going to be the melody line. I think it's always a plus, especially in advertising, to find moments where you can have the melody, even if it's only a couple of bars, because I think those are the hooks that, you know, it hooks people in and it's memorable.
Yeah, totally.
We want to thank MusicBed again for sponsoring this episode of Just Shoot It. If you want to get a free month of MusicBed subscription or 20% off your next single song license, head to musicbed.com and use the promo code Just Shoot It, all one word. Before we get into the rest of this episode, we want to tell you about our Patreon page, patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place where you can support the podcast if you're into it. If you pledge $10, we will mail you a hat. I will personally mail you a hat.
Or in personally. How's it going? I feel like you've been mailing a lot of hats recently.
Yeah, well, you heard that today I got a hat back. The post office said
dibs.
It could not find the address, so it's just really exciting to have people help support us, and it helps us pay our editors and get our next live show on the book.
Yeah, we're already working on the next live show. We hope to see you there. We'll let you know when we have finalized details.
So one more time, patreon.com/justshootitpod. We're here with Micah Fitzerman Blue. How you doing?
Hello. Good.
Thanks for coming, finally.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. I just want to talk for a second about how I know you, because we talk a lot about living in LA and how there's a lot of people that work in the film business here. And you are a dad. I refer to you as like one of the dads in my class, but I'm really talking about your daughter is in the class with my daughter.
Yeah. We've been through the most emotionally raw moments probably of each other's lives together in like delivering a tiny person to preschool that first time and then dealing with their separation anxiety and ours.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're bonded for life, Oren.
Pretty heavy, guys.
It's very heavy.
Yeah. You're the first.
It's real life.
You're the first dad from our class that I've had on the podcast. But I've talked to all the dads.
Don't tell them. Keep it a surprise. Then you'll learn who actually listens.
Oh, yeah.
When I told my assistant this afternoon where I was going, she was like, oh, you're going to do a podcast about preschool dads?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, kind of.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah.
You joke, but there is another dad at our preschool that is doing a podcast about, it's like a preschool mystery. It's about a mom and a preschool, but
yeah,
might as well be a dad.
I thought it was just like the Daddy and Me podcast. That'd be nice. Just like, you know, a bunch of dudes and like baby Bjorns, just like,
I mean,
swapping tips. Oren
and I have taken our daughters to movies together.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is another sort of, you know.
Very LA thing.
Very LA thing. I don't know.
Well, I'm giving you guys a hard time, a tiny bit, but I think that there is a real aspect that's of your lives that is unique in that. Because you're Hollywood people and because like you're in a neighborhood that's very like, you know, writer director centric, you do get to connect in a way that maybe, my parents, like, you know, they were just like, you know, my mom was a teacher. Maybe there were a couple other teachers in my, you know, classes growing up or something like that. But for the most part, like people weren't connecting professionally. They were only connecting personally. So it is neat that you guys get to interact that way.
Yeah. I mean, For me, I feel like I am so starved for the actual kind of human personal connection,
mm-hmm,
the non-professional connection with people who...
You just mean friends is what you mean. Yeah.
Is that what that's called?
Yeah.
Friends?
Yeah, the Jennifer Aniston show.
Oh, yeah. That's great. Yeah, I'm totally a Monica. but, I mean, I think also in our industry, you're dealing with only a very specific slice of ages.
Mm-hmm.
Like everyone is kind of 35.
Yeah.
And if they're 20, they act like they're 35. And if they're 60, they act like they're 35.
Yeah,
everyone's sort of like, you know, regressing to that one kind of feel where everyone's that. And it's actually very wonderful to be around like little kids with people who otherwise are not. It just, I don't know, it just dimensionalizes their lives.
Yeah. Do you worry at all? And I'm just clearly projecting here.
Yeah,
that,
project away.
I feel like my identity is so wrapped up in my art and my work that it's very hard for me to relate to people when they're not kind of doing the things that we do. You know, like your lifestyle is totally different. You're freelance.
No, but some of your best friends are not in film.
Most aren't, though. Or most are, I mean. Pardon me. Like I would say a good 90. We're really talking about people I grew up with and then everyone else.
That's funny. Most of my friends here in LA are actually not people who are in the industry.
Oh, interesting.
My wife is a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
And
she did work for Fox.
Yeah, but right, but really
in the
very
civilian
far
side.
Outside of the
she was
of,
like an
of,
accountant
of, like, the entertainment
or something.
Side. She did corporate social responsibility.
Sure.
You know, she does like public policy. She does that side of the industry, such as it is, and like, I think there is. I actually feel a lot of anxiety around, like, the weird borderlands between friendship and professional stuff.
Sure,
I sometimes don't know if it's friendship is happening or like networking is happening, mm-hmm. And that feeling of not knowing, kind of, it casts this sort of like strange pall over some interactions for me.
And
to
there's
be very
an
honest,
there's an ugly flip side as well, right? Because then it's not
just business, it's also personal, right? So there's a lot of hard decisions people have to make.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, you know, in also in terms of like hiring people onto writing staffs, crew, like I'm always hyper sensitive around hiring friends because I find who are in the industry, because the friendship is so precious and I would hate for it to be compromised if something did not go well on the day or on set or in the writer's room. I would rather kind of keep a healthy boundary and keep them as friends.
Yeah.
There is something interesting. We've actually never, I mean, this is episode 193. We've never talked about this exact thing before.
It's really tricky. I mean, I think especially, you know, especially being a dad, right? You don't have a lot of time to make friends. The friends that you have right now in your life are hopefully, you know, the friendships are durable enough to stand, you know, all of the neglect that you're going to inflict on them mm-hmm. as a parent who has no time, but for like minimum viable social interaction.
Right. Don't expect more than three sentences without me running off to deal with something.
And for me, like in this moment of my life, like I'm just super appreciative of these long-term friendships, and especially for my friends who are in the industry, it's not a thing where I'm trying to be like a dick and denying them opportunity. Any way I can ever help give them opportunity, I will. But I'm super worried always when we're working together that it's not going to go well. And it's not that I've had personally firsthand a lot of bad experiences, but I know so many people who have had massive fallings out.
I think it's fallings out.
Fallings out.
That
surgeons
sounds weird.
General
yeah.
with real friends. Yeah. And like
that is
such a tragedy, because like what we do at the end of the day is make believe, and it's in so many ways less important than like the actual friendships and relationships that we have.
But I guess what I'm curious about in your situation, Micah, is like, did you have the same reticence to trust people's agendas? Like you know, you have a giant movie in theaters right now. People are like talking. There's like award talk. Like,
yeah, you're having a moment.
It's a critical success. You just had another movie. You had this hit TV show. You have a company that's doing, you know, working on these mega giant projects that everyone wants to work on. You're in a different position now than maybe like when you wrote A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, you know,
yeah,
when
you 10 were, years ago.
Yeah. So at that point,
hold on, I want to pump the brakes just for a second. 10 years ago, you wrote A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
It'll be 10 years in January when we first began the project.
When Mr. Rogers just came out.
When we probably had a draft 8.5 years ago, 9 years ago.
Yeah, because I think another thing that's great about the show, not to toot our own horn, but like illustrating how long it takes, you know, is a thing that often feels invisible for people. 10 years. The movie came out like a week ago now, right?
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. Thanks. It's great, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, really wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Matt contributed to the Thanksgiving box office.
I did.
So. Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Friday morning, Alamo Drafthouse. It was fun.
When you first moved to LA and everyone's like in it together, we're all kind of trying to climb to the top. It's a different, you're kind of like, oh, you want to do something? You want to work on something? You want to collaborate on something? You want to meet? You want to do this? It's like a little more open. But I think once you get to a place where you're a little more selective about where you spend your time, maybe now you're like, wait, does this person want to hang out with me? Because they really want to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, it's less about I'm worried that someone's trying to like whatever, take advantage of me. It's really the opposite. It's like I am so protective over the actual friendships that I have that I'm just scared of it not going well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If we work together. So I feel so much more reticent about working with people who I, maybe this is a really strange thing about me, where I feel like
I don't think it is strange. I think it's common.
I think it maybe also brings up a difference between the way that you two broke in, right? Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, Micah, you came in purely as a writer,
right? And then have like developed a directing career after finding success.
Not yet a director. Only producing. Hope to be a director.
Sure. There you go. So then in that case, you don't need a bunch of pals to come over to your apartment and shoot something with you. You're just alone in your sad apartment typing away at an old copy of Final Draft, right?
Yeah. Just actually, I just had a typewriter and a bottle of cheap whiskey. And
sure,
I was just trying.
You just watched the cockroaches
on the wall. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I remember when I moved out, I was, I didn't know what I wanted to be. I knew I wanted to be some kind of writer, and I tried all kinds of different kinds of writing when I was in college.
Did you study writing?
I studied history and literature. Mm-hmm. Like, I was interning here and there, and then I had some time. And
when you say here and there, where do you mean?
I interned at W.W. Norton Book Publisher mm-hmm. in New York. I got to like edit a biography of an author, which was cool, but also publishing was
sure,
at the beginning of the thing that was that felt like just a terrible upheaval.
You could smell it in the air.
Yeah. I mean, whatever. Book publishing's been dying forever,
right?
And yet it hasn't. But what was happening at that company at the time just – it didn't feel healthy, and then it didn't feel like there was an opportunity for me. Then I worked, you know, I thought about doing academia, went, you know, kind of working with a professor, and that felt like the wrong life for me. And then kind of on a lark, I wrote a screenplay, and it really did. I mean, I never thought I'd be somebody who felt like they had a vocation, but like when I wrote a screenplay, which was terrible.
Can you tell us the long line?
It was terrible, and it got me into trouble with my future mother-in-law.
Is it a horror movie about Jewish mother-in-laws?
No. But it was about actually a college roommate of mine who came to college his sophomore year, and he had graduated high school. He's gay, and he knew that he was gay. And he vowed to himself when he graduated high school that he was going to go to college and that he was never going to come out. He was just going to be gay when he got to his freshman year. And he got to freshman year, and it didn't happen. And then...
Like, I don't need to worry about the transition then, because it's all new people.
He was going to use the natural...
Clean slate.
I was going to go by Matthew, and then I introduced myself as Matt, and that was that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. And then he transferred to my college... sophomore year.
He's like, I need a do-over.
And it did work. It was a do-over. Yeah. And then there was this moment when he had friends from high school visiting, and he was like, right when they were like walking up, he was like, oh yeah, by the way,
no one knows.
They don't know that I'm gay.
Oh man.
And I was like, what the fuck? Like, and then, you know, years later I was like, what is the most interesting dynamic that just felt like it felt like character and
that
a secret and
sound
cinematic.
So bad, actually. There's a good screenplay in that.
Oh
idea.
Yeah, totally. I didn't write it.
Maybe it's about the journalist that interviews.
Yeah,
he needed a
friend. Your friend. Yeah.
No, but and so I wrote this screenplay. I wrote it with a friend, and but it was like a month, and it just felt right. And what we produced was not good. But it was wonderful, and I showed it to like, you know, everyone who would read it, and I got like, that's nice.
And had you studied like, you know, did you read screenplay like or
no,
any of that
I just,
stuff?
I think we like got some bootleg copy of like Movie Maker Pro. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even Final Draft. It was something else. It was it felt like Soviet screenwriting software.
Yeah, just like Final Draft now.
So I my mother-in-law got a hold of it. And because
you weren't married yet.
No, sorry. My girlfriend, who then became my fiance and then my wife, and then the mother of my daughter in the preschool that where we are both dads.
Yes,
she, of course, because we were in love, loved it and showed it to her mom. And her mom read this bad screenplay about a college kid
sex comedy.
who was closeted, and then was like to my wife, I think Micah is trying to tell us something, trying to tell you something, and you should listen.
See, that's the angle, right?
What a sweet
you write
lady
it from her point of view.
That's so nice of her, actually.
So it got me in trouble, and it wasn't good, but I loved doing it so much that I wrote another.
So that's the first time you were on a blacklist.
Exactly. I wrote another bad screenplay, a second one, and then I think maybe even a third terrible screenplay. And then that one I sent to somebody who knew somebody who was like an assistant at the William Morris Agency, mm-hmm. RIP, mm-hmm. And he was like, hey, I'm going to pretend to be your agent and you can pretend to be a screenwriter.
I love it when we've heard a version of this story a couple times and it just feels like such a great, like, old fashioned idea that you can't do anymore, basically. Like, no. Now people can Google it in such a significant way. Right?
Yeah.
You mean the pretending or the assistant finding new writer?
The assistant finding new writers. It makes complete sense. But the I'm going to pretend to be your agent. It's like, Google it real quick.
I don't actually know what he did or didn't do. Mm-hmm. All I knew was that it felt real enough to me.
Sure.
That,
I mean, they've got an email address, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. He was an assistant just to a real agent. And he was like, I'll pretend to be your agent, come on out. We'll sell this thing. He didn't. But it was just enough for me to feel
I had something.
I had a little tiny beachhead here that made it all make sense, and that it was at least worth 6 months mm-hmm. to see if it could happen.
And let me ask, just clarifying, what college were you at?
Harvard. It wasn't something that occurred to me to do until very late in my time in college.
It's one thing if you're in a world where people are just doing that. If you were I wrote at the Lampoon and then, I guess I just kind of did some Simpsons or whatever.
There's a way to go to college at Harvard if you know freshman year that you want to be a TV comedy writer.
If you want to do late night or something, that will, you're set.
This is a centuries of privilege.
Sure.
That are just deployed and weaponized against every industry, and Hollywood is not immune to that at all.
Is in the sweet spot, right?
Totally.
But so it's interesting to me that you're not doing that.
I was not doing that.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Well, so,
but still a smarty pants.
This is not a story of me overcoming some pull myself
adversity.
Adversity. I mean. For me, I had parents who were willing to pay for my cell phone. I never had any fear mm-hmm. about starving, putting food on the table mm-hmm. or people were going to take care of me at least up until a point. And it's one of the canards about breaking in, which is that it really does require a safety net. I mean, you cannot earn a living as an intern in Hollywood. You can't earn a living as an assistant in Hollywood. You have to find some other way to make it happen. And the people who come from means or come from privilege have an enormous advantage that just has to be said over and over again until it's not the case.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, it's still at the end of the day, trying to turn something that most people would consider a hobby, which is writing stories and making videos into a career. You need a significant amount of time to float by, to not make money in order to show someone something that's worthwhile paying for.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like David E. Kelly was born and could write an episode of L.A. Law immediately. But for the rest of us, mortals, you don't. It has to be learned. It's a weird form mm-hmm. that requires a lot of things, a lot of experience. And then also just to be a writer, you have to have something to say.
Well,
and I didn't.
Well, I had
my friend's story from college to say.
Well, I want to touch on that. But before we do that, something related is did you have a day job or did you just move out to LA and just type on your typewriter all day long?
The thing I did for pay first was work at a bakery.
Oh, really?
Which bakery?
It was
Taste Tester?
Auntie M's Kitchen in Eagle Rock. It was in the heyday. When I arrived in LA, it was right during the cupcake boom.
Sure.
Of the early aughts.
Yeah. Shout out to Maureen Baruccia from Sprinkles.
Yeah.
Built a career making videos for Sprinkles.
Yeah,
actually.
One of our past guests worked behind the Sprinkles counter and convinced the owners of the company to let her make videos about each cupcake.
She was director for Kimmel movies for a long time. And now, she's got a movie coming out. So.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's amazing. So cupcakes, right?
Sure.
So cupcakes were big business.
Yeah, it's either Harvard Lampoon or cupcakes.
So this is a bakery that had like a pretty prospering counter service and catering business. And they made cupcakes. And I was a baker and I helped them make their cupcakes. And for me, maybe this relates back to what we were talking about earlier, but why I didn't want to be an assistant was because I didn't necessarily want to be spending all of my time kind of in the networking game. I wanted actually to just to meet people who were not in the industry and try to create a community of people that I guess just felt mm-hmm. more sustainable mm-hmm. to me. I don't know if that was right or wrong, but that was just that was my gut. Like, I think it would have been possible for me to get an assistant job had I focused on that. But I also wanted the kind of job that had hours that weren't my prime writing hours, which were the mm-hmm. morning. So I'd work evenings.
So say that one more time. You said you're writing.
I like to write like during the day in the morning. The day. Like
And you became a baker?
Well, no. So it was dessert baking. Which sure, it's not like bread baking where you're waking up at 5 a.m.
I'm imagining you make up at like 4 a.m. Really. Yeah. It doesn't matter. But
like you're right. To bake bread, you wake up at 4 a.m. not 5 a.m.
Thanks, everyone.
Central time.
Comet war abated.
It was just something that I could do that could pay me a little bit and also not infringe on, I think, what I imagined was a space I needed to like get less bad and at writing screenplays.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So now let's go back to the other thing you mentioned, which is you felt like you didn't have any stories you had to tell. Which is, it's a problem I personally have when I look at the projects that I'm excited about. I'm like, well, this is like a real interesting visual thing, or this is like a fun world I want to explore. But then you go and you see Get Out and you're like, but my story is Get Out minus the social message, you know? So it's like, how did you end up finding like meaningful stories that you wanted to tell? I mean, I feel like even this, it's funny because sometimes I like look at my really old ideas and I'm like, oh, that's better than any idea I've had in like the last 5 years. And like your college friend idea seems pretty awesome to me, you know?
No, I mean, it's not like the log line of my friend's life isn't meaningful or isn't a good thing to write about. It's that who I was when I was trying to capture that, I didn't know enough about writing, enough about myself to render it in an authentic way that I thought could be moving to people.
So how does writing A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood have to do with knowing yourself?
I mean, there's this sort of abstract general thing about like becoming a writer where you're bad for a long time and you have to just accept that you're bad for a long time. And for me, and I don't like, it's, there's no way to talk about going to college at Harvard and not sound like an asshole. And I will now accept that. And one of the things about going to school there is it implies certain things about who you were growing up as a kid, which is to be like, I was really academic. I was really into a certain kind of achievement. I was really into the sort of external validation that you get from going to a school like that, from deciding to want to go to a school like that. And what you end up being at the end of like 18 years when you arrive there is you're a professional student. And then what it does when you're there is it reinforces that. So I'm 21 years old and what I'm really good at is being a student. And I overvalued like being intellectual. I overvalued a certain kind of academic intelligence. And I think what has made me a better writer, in addition to just like having more life experience, is actually unlearning a lot of that. Not being like dumber, but to access, reacquaint myself with intuition, with just like the irrational feelings that make for compelling art.
What's that famous Fred Rogers quote? It's better to be deep and simple than shallow and complicated.
That's good enough.
Something to that effect. Yeah, I always think about that because that is kind of like captures what you're saying, right? At Harvard, everyone is like complicated, but they're they relish the amount of complexity that they can kind of understand. Whereas at some point you realize like it's the simplicity, especially in like screenwriting where it's like really about communicating to a mass, you know, amount of people. You want to be simple and meaningful, right? And it seems like that's a hard thing to accomplish as a writer.
So hard to be simple and meaningful. You know, I mean, the people who I know in my life who I consider geniuses are the people who are able to explain incredibly complex things in very simple language, using mostly small words.
Right.
And
with Trumps.
If you will. Yeah. Like, it's that for whatever reason took me a long time to appreciate and to learn.
And look, a little bit of that is just maturity too, right?
Yeah.
Like I think that's why there are so few incredible filmmakers who are 19, right? There's a few out there right now, but like for the most part, that's what makes them so remarkable, right? It's like, it just takes a little bit more growing up and a little more life experience, right?
Yeah, I think it did. And then the real origin story of A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is 10 years ago, my writing partner, Noah Harpster, he was living here in Silver Lake. He had a 2-year-old and a toddler. And he was desperate to basically get any part of his life under control. And his daughter, who wouldn't listen to a thing he said, he put like a YouTube video of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood on, and she like waddles over to the computer screen and starts to listen to him in a way that she had never listened to Noah, would never listen to Noah ever. And then he the next morning, he walks into our office. By which I mean a coffee shop. And
which coffee shop, out of curiosity?
It was Mornings Nights Cafe.
Oh, I don't think I know. In Silver Lake?
Yeah. It is now.
Oh, really, yeah.
Ah, gotcha. There you go. Yeah.
We were there. We were at Cafe Casbah a lot. Mm-hmm, which
sure.
Is now,
La Colombe.
La Colombe.
Yeah.
The coffee shops of Silver Lake. Anyways, Noah comes into, you know, to our quote unquote office and is like, dude, I have just discovered a warlock who speaks toddler and we must write about him. And for us, it began this kind of strange odyssey where...
Wait, so do you just abandon all the other things you were working on? The like mermaid adventure
never.
Film or whatever that you
never,
had?
Never. No, like you keep doing the things that you're doing. It's just, I feel like we've always been multitasking, but we just began to research him and get to know things about Fred Rogers. And we realized...
That's very interesting, yeah, because the film is framed as though it's based off of a specific article, right?
It
or
is.
Or the genesis of the article. But the idea to write about Fred Rogers started before you found that article.
Actually, years before.
That's really interesting.
And so what we realized pretty quickly was that Fred Rogers was a terrible subject for a traditional biopic. He was unwaveringly amazing for 74 years and then he died.
Oh, and not to kiss your butt too much, but I think the thing that makes the movie work is that it's not the same as the documentary that came out a few years ago.
We love the documentary. Right?
And that documentary is great. But like, if you had just done a fictionalized version of that movie, it wouldn't have connected with people in the same way.
I I think it's not just a question of taste. I mean, I personally don't love the Cradle to Grave biopic. I think there are so many wonderful like slice of life, historical fictions, movies like The Queen or Frost Nixon that were always like super inspiring to us.
I liked
Jobs too. Yeah.
It's like four slices.
Yeah, there are ways, and I feel like there's something sometimes disingenuous about the math of a biopic, where it all kind of feels like a bad version of Rosebud.
Sure. Or inspiration for Walk Hard, basically.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
I directed a biopic, and there's very much the like, well, this happened here, but let's put it here because we need this to happen here, and there it does fall into a formula that is like really difficult to escape.
But especially like your movie is about a wrestler, right? And so why do we need to know that much about their childhood? Let's just get to the wrestling, right? That's why Judy was actually really great. Like, it's such a funny, small slice of her life. And look, you get flashbacks, you get context.
Right, or My Week with Marilyn. I mean, it's like you can tell so much about somebody's life or who they are. And for us, it wasn't actually, we decided that it wasn't important for, you didn't have to know where Fred Rogers grew up. What we wanted you to know was what it felt like to have this person in your life. And we realized that he was confrontationally kind, that he
radically,
but in your face about it. He would demand things of the people who he would meet in the course of his life. He would demand a certain kind of intimacy. And for people like Tom Juneau, the journalist whose article we ended up adapting, that was terrifying. That was exactly what he didn't want at that moment. And so in a weird way, Fred Rogers is the antagonist in our movie, right? Like, it's a movie about a journalist played by Matthew Rhys who's trying to write a profile. And the person who's the profile subject is not going to let him do it. He's going to force this journalist to think about himself instead. And it becomes this battle between sort of cynicism and kindness. Like Groundhog's Day? I love Groundhog's Day.
Yeah, where Bill Murray is just like over it, but he's just going to do this dumb profile about this holiday.
Sure.
And then he gets sucked into that day changing who he is as a human being.
Yeah. I mean, and in that way, I mean, like, I don't want to walk on the same hallowed ground as Groundhog Day, but it is similar in that it is a movie. It's a story of like spiritual improvement. It's about trying to become a better person, which weirdly feels like the kind of movie that they don't make a lot of right now, or that have been relegated to like faith-based movies.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Right. Hey everyone, the biggest movie out right now that everyone is talking about is The Irishman. It's on Netflix. It's a Scorsese flick. It's got De Niro. It's got Pacino. It's got Pesci. It's got all sorts of amazing visual effects. And we wanted to tell you about a podcast that is basically the Just Shoot It podcast of The Irishman.
Yeah, it's the official three-part companion podcast from Netflix. The show is called Behind The Irishman. It's hosted by co-star and comedian Sebastian Maniscalco.
They go behind the scenes on costuming, on how they achieved the effects. Really a super deep dive into that movie.
It's conversations with De Niro and Scorsese about like how long it took them to actually make this movie possible, and also how they got Joe Pesci out of retirement.
Yeah.
Home Alone 15 wasn't good enough.
Please watch the movie. It's on Netflix right now before you listen to this podcast, because there's a ton of spoilers. The first episode's already out, and there's new episodes coming out every Monday. And this is just one of a ton of podcasts that Netflix is producing for various shows. They did one for Stranger Things. There's one coming out right now for The Crown. And this is actually their first one that's dedicated to a single film.
Yeah, so if you want to check it out, search for Behind the Irishman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts.
So you wrote this script. It got onto the blacklist. How does that happen? You send it to this person that's pretending to be your agent, or at this point you have?
At this point, I don't know.
Real
I forget
agents.
If we had an agent or not at that point. You know, the script kind of gets around.
You send it to your friends? What do you mean gets around?
I mean, we had.
Yeah, so, the people in Milwaukee are like, what do you mean gets around?
Oh, I'm
around?
Sorry. So
genuinely, though.
By the way, Micah's from Oklahoma, so
I am from Oklahoma.
Great, there you go.
And my mom spent many years living in Milwaukee,
and she's like, "What the fuck are you talking about?
Beautiful city."
Gets around. I don't know what you mean.
I think that's a hint. Micah is trying to tell you he's a swinger.
There you go. But genuinely, I think Hollywood, I think people tend to use more jargon than we realize sometimes.
You're right. Let me rephrase. We had a manager, and the manager submitted the screenplay to different production companies to gauge their interest. And we got a lot of passes. But assistants, who are the people who vote on the blacklist, liked the screenplay. And when the list came out, we were on it.
And this was before the website then.
Before the website, this was when it was just like Franklin Leonard's like project
that he was
doing to try to sort of shine a light on unproduced screenplays. But I should say, by the time we were on the blacklist, we already had the movie set up at Big Beach, and we already had financing.
We
already had a producer.
How many years ago was this?
This was in 2012.
And so
7 years ago.
Franklin Leonard, who runs the blacklist, I think he is, I think he was always visionary about what this thing could be if he were given the resources. And this is that. And I think he's doing all kinds of interesting things kind of all over the industry to try to like shine a light on new voices in screenwriting. For us, it was the old school V1 organic version of the blacklist, where it was just a list of people.
He's literally got a spreadsheet where he's tallying who likes what. Yeah.
Little tick marks to see like, you know, who likes what. It's funny. Like, we've been doing a lot of interviews around the movie coming out, and this is like the least linear version of the telling of the development of this.
Sorry.
Of this movie.
Welcome to Just Shoot It. Yeah.
So I'm a little bit like the timelines are now kind of getting a little bit choppy in my mind. The story is we got interested in Mr. Rogers. We found a book called I'm Proud of You, written by Tim Madigan, who's a journalist who has a similar thing happen. It's a true story. It's a memoir. And we ended up optioning that book and then adapting it. We hired ourselves to adapt it.
And who paid to option it? You guys did?
We did.
That an expensive thing?
No, it was like basically a free option. It was just an agreement that we could do this.
Do you pitch like your vision of the script?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And we did, and we wrote a version of what would end up one day being A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And that's what got our friend Yuri Henley, the producer, interested, and that's what wound up at Big Beach with Leah Holzer and Peter Seraph. And then we all together got filmmakers, got directors, and then we all went thinking that this was a slam dunk.
Sorry, I'm going to stop you there. Got directors.
Yeah.
How do you go about doing that? What'd you do? Literally, is it like, oh, who do we like? Who's at our agency?
Yeah, I mean,
that sort of thing, or no?
Well, we had a list, but it was directors that that Big Beach had worked with before.
There you go.
And then, and so they sent the script to them, and then they were like, great. And then we ended up going to Pittsburgh, and we meeting with the person who runs Fred Rogers' company, which at that time was called Family Communications Company, and he was like, okay, you guys seem nice. Before we begin, just so you know, there will never, ever, ever be a Fred Rogers movie. And
you're like, great, we're not writing that.
And so we ended up just like kind of begging, humiliating ourselves, not going away over the course of months, which became years. And eventually they led us into the archive. The Fred Rogers Archive, which is in Western Virginia. And we're in the archive. And, you know, Noah and I had read this article by Tom Juno before. And, you know, we're getting the feeling like maybe our version of this movie that we had written wasn't quite right. And we're in the archive, and we're basically in a pile of handwritten letters. Because Fred Rogers wrote handwritten letters to people, you know, dozens of people a day. And he would pray for people by name. He would meet people in the course of his life, and he would minister to them. He was, like I said, you know, he was this compulsively kind person. So he would absorb the thing that he would see in you. He would see right through whatever you were trying to do, trying to cover for, ask you a cutting question, find out what was going on in your life, and then help.
Yeah.
As best he could.
And, you know, it's so interesting. I read an Atlantic article by the author.
By Tom.
And he mentions that, like, he studies very hard to do that sort of work. Like, he takes notes on, like, emails and, yes, like, writes down people's names. Like,
so we had all
of
that.
He's incredibly thorough in the way in which he's
intentionally,
you know, kind to people.
And we love the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, because it gives you this, like, broad view of Fred Rogers' impact on the world.
You're a little mad they took that name, though.
Well, we had luckily there were enough to choose from. But our movie, we had only ever wanted to tell the story of Fred Rogers' impact on you, mm-hmm, on individual people, because that was this other part of his life that was less well publicized. And so we're in the archive, and we see this box labeled Tom Juneau. And we're like, can we see that box? And it's brought down for us. We're wearing these, like, you know, these white cotton, mm-hmm, archival gloves. And, mm-hmm, we open the box, and it's 200.
God,
it's
so
like
hot.
200 letters that they had exchanged. Emails, funny, handwritten letters. Yeah. And in that moment, it was like, oh, this is the movie.
A weird Mr. Rogers question. Did you get the sense that he printed those letter, like the emails, did he print them out and then say, oh, we're going to archive these? Or did someone else, an archivist, go through all of his emails?
It was an archivist, okay, after he died.
Yeah.
And can I ask you, and this can, you can give like a general answer to this if it helps, but like, what about your script felt not right? Like, how did you realize like there is a better version of this?
We just felt like it's a general answer. It was just like, you're kind of turning off your brain a little bit. At least I am when I'm doing my best work and being most honest. And just like, what does it feel like? And we felt like there was a better feeling thing that we could do, that we could make.
We all relate to, or at least most people relate to, being affected by that show, right?
Yeah.
And we don't relate to being Mr. Rogers in quite the same way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess, like, as a screenwriter, a lot of times I feel like you are in this place where you're like, there's probably a better version of this story, but let's just send this out and see how goes, you know?
I mean, I think the other sort of, like, the other thing just to note, what was happening in our lives at the same time as we were doing all this work, is we were writing on Transparent. And being writers and producers on that series, I mean, for every 30-page screenplay or 30-page teleplay, we would write like 200 pages.
Really?
So at the time, the idea of like rewriting or heavily revising anything didn't faze us at all.
Wait, why would you be rewriting so much on Transparent?
That was just the process. It was just like a highly iterative room.
Is that how you work on everything, or was that specific to Transparent?
I mean, a lot of shows do a lot of drafts. Jill Soloway, as a showrunner, at least on Transparent, wanted to see the version that we had discussed. So you would write that version. And so, you know, for Noah and I, who write fairly quickly, you kind of learn the hard way to get out of your own way. You leave your ego outside of it, and you just sort of do the work, and you kind of see how it looks. So,
When you're doing that, do you get like super excited about like a line of dialogue or a moment or a beat or a visual? And then when it's torn apart, you're just like, no problem. We'll just do something different.
I mean, you endure countless indignities and tragedies, watching things that you think are wonderful, you know, fall by the wayside anytime you're in any collaboration. Because what we do together is to try to like find some common ground between all of our imaginations. I am not someone who is precious about dialogue. I'm someone who is precious about trying to convey the big feeling. You know, I think I learned the hard way. Not the hard way, like bad things happen, but I suffered a lot, you know, fighting for phrasing, fighting for syntax, fighting for words to be spoken in the way that they sounded in my head. And it's such folly to try to do that in this industry. You'll have a very short career if that's what happens every single time someone makes it their own. Like, I think of a screenplay as it's like a bonfire. Like, people want to gather around it, and it's the beginning of a conversation. And I hope as a screenwriter that like I'm setting par, kind of. Ooh, that's cool. That's a sports metaphor. Yeah, I don't usually golf. Do those. Golf, yeah, golf, guys. Like, I hope that what happens on the day is way better than what I have on the page.
On the day, you mean on the shoot?
Sorry. I think of a screenplay as sort of setting par for what a cast and a crew is going to do when they film something. I hope that it's way better than what I have on the page. And I pray that it's not worse.
Right.
I think it's so interesting to hear, or rather to think about the gift of a show like Transparent or kind of any, you know, great TV show. There's a churn to it, right? So like
I love the churn.
You're suffering those indignities so quickly and then seeing what the result is and realizing, oh, it wasn't so bad. Like, maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong, but like the show is the show already. And then you're already back in the writer's room. You're already working so fast that like you just iterate much faster.
Yeah. You get out of your way.
Yeah.
And is that on Transparent? That's just coming from Jill Soloway, just saying like, that doesn't feel right, or that's not right, or like, what if we do this, like, or bring this character into the storyline, like, and then
on Transparent. I mean, I was part of it from the very beginning, like the early days, and it was always this place where, like, you know, inspiration was lurking for better and worse. So new ideas, like you know, new shit would come to light, and you would write about it, and it was, you know. It was my job and Noah's job in part to like raise the barn over and over again. Like, whatever, that's a technical term, by the way, in Hollywood, that means raising a barn. It was our job to like kind of get a script up on its feet and say like, hey, what do you think? Is this working? Mm-hmm. And people be like, no, it's not working. Do it this way, or let's try it this way. And then we would get it right. And you know, we were doing that on, you know, every episode of the season. And then you'd bring it to set and the actors would be like, I don't know about this. And then you'd rewrite on set, and then of course the coverage would shift over the course of filming, because if you're changing it all the time,
sure,
and the blocking changes, then the way that it's shot changes.
Just made me nervous right there. Yeah. I just got sweaty.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And then you would get to post, and then you'd be writing it in post, because what would end up there in the footage was different from what it was in the screenplay and what it was, you know, on set when you were filming it on the day. And you would just write it again and write it, you know, with the editors and the post staff. And that process ended up being an incredible boot camp for me and Noah. Mm-hmm. Because we learned to kind of ride the chaos and ride some of the lightning and to keep breathing. Mm-hmm. And to have whatever amount of distance that you need from something to be able to work on it at the same time as a lot of like very loud voices are kind of all around.
And it's still personal. So I want to juxtapose this, though, because I think it's interesting. You've got this intense thing that's happening, right? Like everything about Transparent is active and shifting all of the time.
Not to mention when it comes out, it's like a very cutting edge show.
Yeah, yeah, sure. People are talking about
a new streaming service
and
with
also,
like a new voice.
You've got this old idea that like you've been working on for a bunch of years with your writing partner about Mr. Rogers and there's a documentary already coming out. How do you stay interested in a project for that long? And also, was part of it just the fact that you get to go to Pittsburgh and like kind of reinvigorate yourself with kind of the different things that are happening culturally around the story and, you know, new articles and discovering new things? How do you keep the romance alive on this kind of back burner project?
I mean, that, as I understand it, is a lot of what the job of film producing is keeping your eyes a little bit higher up on the horizon, of keeping the people interested and excited, even during the times when it feels like impossible or dormant or slow. And, you know, it's where having a community of people you're working with around the movie is useful. We had producers, Yuri, Peter, Leah, who were just there throughout. So we were all kind of having the same experience together. You know, and Marielle Heller directed an episode in the second season of Transparent.
Sure.
And we were discussing, you know, we were just shooting the shit and she was like, what are you working on? And we said, oh, well, you know, between all of this, where you have this Mr. Rogers thing. And she said, I'll never forget. She was like, why aren't I directing that? Which is like the most Mari thing she could say. And we're like,
and she already did Secret Life.
She did Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Diary of a Teenage Girl, yeah.
And we're like, I don't know. Because somebody else is. And then, of course,
so you had someone else attached.
We had somebody else attached. And then they fell out. And we went to Mari. And she's just so wonderful.
That's awesome. We should wrap up pretty soon. But on that note, I have two more questions. And we'll give Matt two questions. On the top of Mariel, you obviously... Right. And that's how you get into this business. But you're also producing, which part of producing is like figuring out what team is going to make this movie. What do you look for in a director that wants you to work with them, that gets you to want to work with them?
I mean, a director, like a writer or like an actor, like they serve different purposes at different points in the process. This is a complicated, maybe this is an overcomplicated answer, but... You know, sometimes you need like a movie star to get someone to care about the thing that you're working on. Sometimes you need a writer to know that like progress is being made on a thing and someone's actually working on it. I think what you look for in a director and what a director is best at in terms of as a producer, first of all, if they're a certain kind of director, it means your movie's going to get made because they're the people who make movies and they don't sort of attach to everything kind of willy-nilly. But, you know, and Mari is the kind of director who, when she attaches to something, she means it. But I think in development, when a movie's not yet made, a director, especially one with a track record, is the best possible shorthand for what the vision of the movie is going to be.
Like in a, when you're like tone wise?
Yeah. What, like our movie feels like in all the ways that you want a Mari Heller movie. It has all of, it has the lived in quality. It has the handmade quality. It's about the performances. And when we brought her on, that's what, you know, not to commodify her, but that's what we were saying about our movie. We were saying, these are the things that are important to us.
Right. So for our listeners, let's say they're trying to pitch to get a job on a movie. is it, do you like, I guess what you said about Mari right now is interesting, that it's not literally about like, she made these three movies and they all seem to have a certain thing and we want that for our movie. You're saying she's, it's less about the specifics of what the movie was or even what the tone of the movie was, and more about what she seems to excel at, which is like performances, which is kind of a cinematic lived in look. So if you're a filmmaker that has made maybe two or three movies that are drastically different from each other, do you think that's a point against you, or do you think?
No, I mean, I think it just might be a more of a challenge to be able to communicate your vision. Like, you're going to have to do maybe some more work to be very clear with what it is you're after. I mean, there are so many, I mean, you think about like directors like Steven Soderbergh, where they've directed one of everything.
Right.
You know, he can slide into any genre and he's done them all. And I think it's part of, you know, his mind to try to like see if he could even pull off X or Y or Z, and he can. Sometimes it less well, but he does it. I think in the case of Mari, and I think this movie is different in good ways, but it's also of a piece with the work that she does, and it plays to her strengths. And I think Mari is the kind of director who knows what she likes to make and how she likes to work and what kinds of stories make sense for all the ways that she likes to work and how she likes to make movies. And this fit that nicely.
And so when you're hiring for TV, where it's a little bit more plugging someone into a moving train.
Yeah.
Is that, do you look for different things?
For TV, I mean, it depends on the show. I think for Transparent, how we hired directors was a unique process that was one of the coolest parts of working on anything ever. It was the way that that Jill hired people and brought people in to the show who didn't have the same kinds of opportunities and experiences that other people had in traditional Hollywood, kind of the spin cycle of staffing and hiring a directing team. You know, Jill was interested in the behind the camera, reflecting the vision of a future state in our industry and in the world. And, you know, it was in part Noah and my job as like this, some of the few like cis straight white guys who, I think our biggest qualification was that we already had Final Draft, was to like help empower everybody else, help to just be part of the kind of the safety net. And then of course, like everyone who worked on that show is now working all over town. But for TV, generally, I like people who understand and have respect for TV. I think TV is so much more inherently collaborative than film often is. And you want people who understand the rhythm of it, or who have at least have respect for the rhythm of it, and know that what they're doing, especially if they're coming on to a long running series, is at the very least to do the job very well, and then to do the job so well that you leave time for the actors to play around and to do what they want to do. And if you're the kind of TV director who's chewing up the whole day by putting together some long, you know, oneer or some tracking shot that's just gonna like drive the crew crazy and is gonna be cut up anyways because that's not the look of the show, that's always less exciting for me. The directors who love actors are the directors that I love working with, because all you want to do is, I think, as all of us, we just want to watch actors do good acting and be vessels for emotions. And anything that prevents that from happening, I feel like, is doing a disservice to what it is we're all doing.
Yeah.
Or trying to do.
That's the only reason Matt and I married actors, is to prove to people that we love them. That's awesome. Okay, so my last question is about kind of maybe, I guess, asking a piece of advice. If you're a new filmmaker, a new writer, you just moved to LA, you haven't, don't have really any notable produced credits. What's your advice in terms of like finding the right story that can kind of like how, do you have any advice on how to find the story to tell? Like how to find your A Beautiful Day, or, cause as you know, yeah, you've worked on Maleficent too, and you worked on Transparent, which is based on Jill's life.
Yeah.
And you worked on your own personal things. Like, I guess you've worked on everyone else's stories and your own stories. How do you decide what the next story to tell is?
Yeah, I don't think our career is a good model for, it's not, it's weird. We do a lot of different stuff. And let me start over. My advice to someone who is just moving to LA or just starting out in the industry, wherever they want to start out, is to give yourself a lot of leeway to fail and forgive yourself in advance for the amount of failure you're going to do, and to take the time to figure out what you're good at. Whatever that moment is where it stops feeling like work or a grind and it feels like flow or bliss or whatever the fuck you want to call it. Like, there are those moments and they're fleeting and they don't happen often early. And when you find it, you know it. And like, that's the dragon that's actually worth chasing. That's actually something that you want to duplicate and find ways to touch as many times as possible. And I think it takes a long time for some people to figure out what they're good at. I know so many people who came out as comedy writers or comedy directors and ended up directing horror because what they were good at was timing. They were less interested in the grind of writing jokes over and over again.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, horror is so, it's so rhythm-based. And so, but they didn't know that. It took them years to sort of meander toward that. And they found their, you know, their home. I think it's about getting as many touches as possible. And for me, early on, I just sort of set my default setting to yes. It was like, hey, we need a writer for yes. I will do that. I will try that. But we also need a writer for, okay, I'll do that too. Like anything that is writing that I can get my hands on, figure out if I'm good at it or not, I want it to do.
Cool. Great answer.
Well, Micah, this was great. Shall we hop into unpaid endorsements?
Yes.
Yeah.
Unpaid endorsements.
First one is, I was on an airplane yesterday and I watched a movie that by all accounts should have been bad. And I absolutely loved it. And it's called Game Night. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah, it's actually super good. Yeah.
It's like somebody told me.
It's
like,
also a perfect airplane movie, actually.
Yeah. They're like, you should watch this because the directing is really good. And I'm like, okay, it's a movie about a bunch of friends that get together for game night and then it goes out of control. Like, and that is pretty much exactly what the movie is. But it's just so funny. There's this one scene. Have you seen it, Michael?
I have. I like it a lot. It's really funny.
Where Rachel McAdams is like trying to figure out how to find, like, dig the bullet out of Jason Bateman's arm, and she's reading the instructions on her phone and the phone keeps turning off and she has to use her nose to like tap it so that
it's really good.
It turns back on. It's just like so relatable and ridiculous at the same time. And Jesse Plemons, who is, you know, amazing in Breaking Bad and Black Mirror and everything else he does, is just so hilarious. He plays
that guy can do anything.
Cop.
I think John Francis Daly
he directed it.
Directed it, and he was like from Freaks and Geeks. He's like the little boy.
Oh, is that who he is?
Yeah.
Okay. There's this one shot in the house where they're throwing around that Fabergé egg, where the camera is just flying from the first floor to the second floor, and then to an extreme close-up, and it's like kind of Fincher-esque, but much more fun than like an insane David Fincher shot. I think if you're into filmmaking, it's worth watching, and I think it's a movie you can watch with your like non-filmmaking friends, and they will appreciate it as well.
I think that might still be on HBO streaming as well.
Oh, cool. Well, it's definitely on Southwest Airlines. second thing, Cyber Monday. I got this. I just got it, so I might unendorse in the future, but I got this Dyson V8. It's changed my life in the one day I've had it.
Pretty into it.
It's just this handheld vacuum cleaner that is just really sucks. And then my last thing, Lorraine Scafaria, who directed Hustlers, she posted on Twitter the like Rip-O-Matic that she used to show her vision of what the movie's going to be.
Oh, cool.
And it's like above and beyond the best Rip-O-Matic I've ever seen. I've seen so many Rip-O-Matics from like huge directors. They're like, this is how I was sold my Marvel movie or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, okay, some good scenes. You know, the problem with the Rip-O-Matic is like you're taking everyone else's good scenes and trying to mash them together. And it's hard to tell where you are in that, you know. But what she put together with her editor, whose name I forget, but who she credits a lot to her editor as well, is like, it's so intentional and so different from all the movies she's pulling scenes from. Like she has scenes from Bridesmaids and scenes from Showgirls and scenes from like thrillers and things and Scorsese films. And I don't know, it's just really, really worth watching if you ever are trying to pitch on a movie and you don't have any resources to shoot something and are going to just edit something together. I think hers is like the pinnacle of like what you should try to achieve. And we'll post that too. And if you haven't listened to our Elaine Goldsmith Thomas interview, who produced that movie, it's worth listening to. Okay, Matt, you got anything?
I do. I'm going to endorse actually a pair of comic books, House of X and Power of 10, or Power of X, depending on how you want to say it, are two kind of concurrently running X-Men comics that rebooted a couple months ago now. And like, I grew up reading X-Men comics and like loved them. And stopped caring about them as a child, basically, and still loved comic books for a long time. And then someone told me about these, and they are so good and so radical and so familiar feeling in that, like, they're still the same old X-Men that you grew up loving.
And these are new comic books.
They're new comics, but then also go so far into the, like crazy bonkers sci-fi, like next gen sort of storytelling. And there's all sorts of crazy non-linear stuff that I don't want to spoil, but like it's two different series that are running concurrently that you kind of are meant to read at the same time. And I really loved them, and it kind of is relaunching all of the new X books now. But House of X and Power of 10, I can't endorse enough. And I think they're doing a new collection of them relatively soon. So, or you can just grab them on Comixology real fast. It's very addictive. It's great. So good.
Cool.
This might break the rule, but I'm going to do an unpaid endorsement of the first 20 minutes of The Irishman because I haven't seen any more of it. I started it last night with my wife, and then she got really tired. She's pregnant, and she was like, I have to stop this, but you do too. And so
that's a good sign. Kara would be like, dude, you can watch it without me.
Going for it. Yeah.
So, so far, we've seen like Robert De Niro old, him half old, and then him younger, but also in sort of an old man's body.
Sure. That's a criticism I've heard actually.
It's there.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like I know what the story is yet. But whatever is going to happen, I'm on board. It feels like a mini series.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
I'm just excited to watch.
There's a
it's now apparently a mini series in my life.
Well, right. Scorsese's going to be mad at you for saying that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. No. He explicitly was like, it's not a mini series. Watch it one sitting.
But it's a mini. It's three and a, it's too long.
I had
take it up with
I was
Marty,
talking
man.
To a mom at our kid's school today, and she's like, oh, yeah, we've been watching The Irishman. I'm like, I think it's a movie. She's like, well, yeah, but we've been watching it over the course of
over the course of several days. And the other one I wanted to endorse is a new supergroup, a musical supergroup called The High Women, like The Highwaymen, but The High Women.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about this group?
No.
It's a super country group of Brandi Carlile, Maren Morris, Natalie Hemby, and Amanda Shires, who all like got together to write songs in Nashville, and they put this album out. It's self-titled, and it's been the thing in my house that has pushed out Frozen the soundtrack.
Like your daughter likes
And my daughter likes music. It and I like it. And it has kind of like some good outlaw country vibes to it. And I think Brandi Carlile has the best voice in music. And so
it's I'm better really than Lost it. In the Woods.
They're doing things that I think Olaf couldn't even dream right. of.
Yeah.
Was that Frozen 2 song?
Yeah, Lost in the Woods. Oh, you haven't seen, but you said you've been listening to the soundtrack.
I've listened to the Frozen 1 soundtrack to prepare for Frozen 2.
People are going to think this podcast is from years ago.
I'm so sorry. Lost in the Woods. No, I haven't. That shit will not be played in my house until
that's a Jonathan Groff.
Okay.
Song.
Sorry.
It's pretty good.
Hey, whatever you guys
sorry say. For missing the
the reference. Cool. Those are great endorsements. And the Irishman is actually our sponsor for this podcast.
But those first 20 minutes, because I haven't seen the rest.
Yeah, that's all they sponsored.
Quite good.
The first
Quite
20 good. Minutes.
Off to a great start, Marty.
The kid's going places.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks. Do you tweet or anything? Can people follow you?
I'm not on social media. You cannot follow me.
You have a company, right? Red Trumpet?
Uh-huh.
Red Trumpet Media?
Yeah, it's Blue Harp.
Blue Harp. Do you guys have a website?
No.
MDB Pro page?
Yep.
Cool. And you have shows coming out and movies coming out and a lot of things.
Those things.
So,
deadline.com. Is there anything you can say that people should keep an eye out for in case they're a fan of everything you said so far?
No.
All right. Great. Just consume media.
Maybe soon.
At
maybe
random.
Soon.
Cool. Well, if you have
if you like dramas, keep an eye out.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening. If you have any questions, you can email us at justshootapod@gmail.com or on all social media at justshootapod. We love to hear your questions. You can call us at 1-626-2-SHOOT-1.
You got it.
Leave us a voicemail. Let us know what you think. And I am on Instagram at okaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media. The show is at Just Shoot It Pod. This episode was edited by Jonathan Luna. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams, and you're listening to The Artist Jazar, provided by the Free Music Archive. Additional music by MusicBed.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.